Here are three things you need to know about today. President Trump keeps threatening Russia with deadlines and more sanctions, and now a new one that is completely off the wall and frankly dangerous. Mr. Trump is sending nuclear submarines off the coast of Russia because he didn't like a mean tweet. It's an action ex-US military officials are calling insane. And it's not just Russia that Mr. Trump is going after, by the way, these days. He's also naming China and India and Brazil. So what is their reaction? Are they going to buckle under in fear? That's coming up right here when it gets the Sanchez effect. Let's do this. Hi, everybody. I'm Rick Sanchez. And I want to share something with you because I hope that someday you are going to be able to experience this, even though it's tough to do it if you're in the United States, for example. And well, because, well, you'll understand the world a little bit better if you do what I did this past weekend. I know it sounds weird, but just stay with me here. Let me start with this corny amateur photography. And I took these pictures. That's my wife. We've been married for some 36 years now. And this weekend, we decided to hang out in St. Petersburg, a city that is like Venice, but on steroids. Water everywhere, historic canals, rivers, bridges, museums, palaces, architecture to rival, swear to God, any city in the world, including London, Rome, Prague, the Vatican, you name it. There's so much to learn from in this city. Lessons from the past, for example. It could be useful today. Tell me if this doesn't sound familiar, because this is one of the stories you get in that city. A leader with all sorts of embarrassing scandals who doesn't want anybody to know about those scandals, so he hides them and threatens war to divert the people's attention. Well, that was the case of Tsar Nicholas. It was a mess back then. He didn't want anybody to know that his son was a hemophiliac. Rumors that his wife was sleeping with some monk named, as you know, you've read about this, Rasputin. And against his better judgment, he dragged his country into World War I. Huge and stupid and foolish mistake. Am I describing President Clinton, by the way, and his actions post-Monica in Belgrade? Because that's what he did. Maybe President Bush's actions post-cocaine scandal in Iraq? Because that's what he did. How about Biden's Hunter problem? Scandal and his sudden obsession with Ukraine, because that's what he did. And now, just as President Trump's favorable ratings have plummeted to less than 40% in some polls, amid allegations that he was best friends with an accused child molester, oh, lo and behold, he's threatening Russia. And why is he threatening Russia? He's threatening Russia with nuclear submarines. Nuclear friggin' submarines over a mean tweet from, well, this one really takes the cake. You ready? It's a mean tweet by Dmitry Medvedev. And here's Trump's insane response.
Based on the highly provocative statements of the former president of Russia, Dmitry Medvedev, I've ordered two nuclear submarines to be positioned in the appropriate regions, just in case these foolish and inflammatory statements are more than just that.
It's a tweet, and it's not even from the president. I mean, look, I got to tell you, man, I hate to say this. I hate to say this because, like many Americans, I really believed in this guy, Mr. Trump. I know, call me an idiot, but at least try and let me explain myself before you call me an idiot. When he first ran, I thought he was both dumb and crazy, like a lot of Americans did. But after watching Biden in office for 4 years, I and many Americans thought, you know what? They really did sabotage his presidency. So maybe Mr. Trump does deserve another opportunity. And the American people gave him that other opportunity. But Trump, he's a used car salesman. Though what he sold wasn't a pack of lies about a jalopy or an old car. He sold the idea that he would stop Israel in Gaza. He's done just the opposite. He sold the notion of better relations with China. They've never been worse. He said he would figure out this conflict in Ukraine and mediate a peaceful solution, help the United States reestablish better relations with Russia. Instead, he's now threatening Russia with friggin' nuclear submarines. I mean, here's what some really smart Americans, and there's a lot of them out there, by the way, are saying about this situation.
I don't understand why Trump is making these threats. Do you really think that this makes sense? It's typical Trump. He just operates by the seat of his pants, makes all these threats, then backs off. And by the way, if you're the Russians and you're watching this, you have to say to yourself, what does this tell us about dealing with the United States moving forward? Is there any hope for diplomacy? Is there any hope that we can work out some sort of modus vivendi with these people? I think the answer is no.
I think the answer is no. Yet, right? What do you think? Mearsheimer, by the way, who has forgotten more about the conflict in Ukraine than Mr. Trump knows will ever know or cares to know, is referring to diplomacy here. But for Scott Ritter, a Marine and former U.S. weapons inspector, what Mr. Trump is doing isn't just stupid, according to him. It's downright dangerous.
This is insanity. This is as dangerous as it gets, because now the Russians have to take this deployment seriously. They have to act as if the United States is preparing for a preemptive nuclear strike. And remember, nothing happens in a vacuum, because just prior to this stupidity in terms of the president's overreaction to a mean tweet, the president of the United States ordered B-61-12 gravity bombs, nuclear bombs, to be deployed to England.
But he's not done yet. Ritter, who says what Mr. Trump has done is unprecedented, because he's really doing two things that no president should ever do. First of all, and I don't know if you've thought about this, when I heard him say this, I said, gosh, that's right. He's endangering the lives of U.S. personnel. There's Americans on those ships, on those submarines, because he's giving up their positions. He's telling the whole world where they are. Two, he's playing a very lethal and dangerous game of chicken with Russia, a very formidable opponent.
Now, you're the Russians monitoring this. You're saying, what are you doing? Getting ready for a preemptive strike against Russia? Which means now the new Russian doctrine is they're going to be increasing their alert threshold. And if they detect additional movement, the Russians may be called upon to preempt our preemption. We're in a situation now where this has stopped being funny. This is not about mean tweets and overreaction to the president being stupid and feeding every, you know, meme generation device out there. This is about the survival of the world.
Damn, the survival of the world. Survival of the world. By the way, look, it's important to note that reacting hastily to threats, which is what, you know, my president, Mr. Trump, is doing in this case, is exactly what Russia has not done since this whole thing started. And the threats that Russia has gone through, you know, they've been a lot more real, a lot worse, a lot more concrete. Russians have been killed, you know? And Mr. Putin and the Russians have said, all right, let's just be patient. Patience. I mean, look, I'll take you through some of these. First and foremost, the U.S. has issued $300 billion in funds and weapons to be used against Russia. Is that not a threat? Missile strikes against Russia have been approved by Biden. U.S. weapons, intel, personnel, they're used to guide the weapons that have been fired at Russian cities and killed Russians. U.S. and British intel services assist Ukrainians who carry out terrorist attacks, which have derailed Russian trains, blown up Russian bridges, assassinated Russian generals in their hometowns. You want to talk about threats? You want to talk about threats? And then there's the constant threats against Russia, China, India, and Brazil from the man that President Trump, by the way, calls his bestie, you know, one of his best friends. Who, by the way, comedians in the United States have a different name for him. They call this guy Lady Lindsay.
The game has changed when it comes to you, President Putin. You have played President Trump at your own peril. You made a major league mistake, and your economy is going to continue to be crushed. We're flowing weapons to Ukraine, so you will have, Ukraine will have the weapons to fight Putin back. But here's what I would tell China, India, and Brazil. If you keep buying cheap Russian oil to allow this war to continue, we're going to tariff the hell out of you, and we're going to crush your economy, because what you're doing is blood money. You're buying cheap Russian oil at the expense of the world, and President Trump is tired of this game. If I were President Putin, I would get to the table soon, because he's about to get crushed.
You see the idiot laughing who apparently is interviewing him? That's supposed to be a journalist, but in America, any idiot could be a journalist. So, you know, nice hair too, right? sorry, I shouldn't have said that. I apologize. But did you hear what he said? I mean, a direct threat to President Putin, letting him know that he's about to get crushed. As for China and India, that the U.S. is going to tear the hell out of them and that they too are going to get crushed. Those are fighting words. I mean, and yet President Putin has hardly even responded except to say that he's willing to negotiate an end to the war in Ukraine. If somebody in the West will just hear him out, but they don't want to hear him out. Instead, they say he has to just stop the war, cease fire, stop the war, stop the fighting, and get nothing in return. It's crazy. By the way, they're crushing it. They're winning the war. The reason the war is continuing at the expense of Ukrainian people is because the West is making the war continue. As for the threats of secondary sanctions to other countries of up to 500%, as Mr. Trump has said, or whatever the latest number is that he plans to throw out, I mean, thus far, these target countries are all ignoring or scoffing at what Mr. Trump is saying. Indian officials said yesterday, look, nobody tells us where we can or can't buy our oil. China's actually saying, they came out this morning and said the threats are causing it to develop closer ties with Russia. That didn't work, huh? And Brazil, President Lula da Silva, he put on his boxing gloves, I guess. He says he's had enough, and here's what he's going to do about it.
I will not overlook the importance of the diplomatic relationship with the United States, which has lasted for 201 years. I will not forget that they also staged a coup here. They helped carry out the coup. But what I want to know is what to do from now on. From now on, they must understand that we have something to negotiate. We have size, we have posture, we have economic interests and political interests to negotiate. I will not give up on believing that we need to seek to build an alternative currency so that we can trade with other countries. I don't need to be subordinated to the dollar.
The U.S. has a history of threatening and invading countries. You know that. I know that because I covered many of those places, those stories from Iraq. I was in Grenada, Cuba, Venezuela as a correspondent for CNN, as a correspondent working for NBC News. But you'll notice that with due respect to all of those countries, one of which where I was born, none are exactly what you would call powerhouses, right? These are not superpowers. Small to mid-sized nations, the U.S. has throttled militarily and economically, still is in most cases. That's what makes this so different. The countries that Mr. Trump is taking on now are powerful. They literally make up half the world or more. In fact, you could say they are more powerful, right? What with the military might of China and Russia alone, equaling if not surpassing that of the U.S., economic growth of India and China besting the U.S.'s GDP growth year in and year out by a significant margin. Those are the BRICS nations. That's the Global South community. And they aren't having it. They are seemingly saying to Mr. Trump, you know what? Look, we're tired of being pushed around, and we're ready to push back. So the question now, in this global game of chicken involving Mr. Trump's newest deadline, is who will blink first? By the way, I mentioned something to you a little while ago. These mean tweets from Mr. Medvedev, how mean were they? Well, they're kind of mean. So when we come back, I'm going to let you read them for yourself. I'm going to show them to you. And then I'm going to be joined by our guest, Danny Heifong. He's a podcaster with a YouTube channel that is killing it. He has almost, well, 500,000 people who've subscribed, and his interviews are usually must-watch TV. He's good. I watch. And he's going to join me next when we come back.
Hey, I see you're washing the Moscow mules. And we're going to brainwash the crap out of you.
Getting word from Red Square.
Who are you? I don't care what my voters say.
I am not a warmonger. I am a peacemaker.
Eating the dogs, eating the cats.
Huggy, there you go. All squeaky clean.
We're in Kabardina, Balkaria, a breathtaking mountainous region where the unique traditions of the people here run as deep as the valleys and gorges. So join us to find out how the rich local culture shines through the clothes, crafts, and dances that have been passed down from generation to generation.
We need to counter the Russian state-controlled narrative.
Als Teil der Sanktionen gegen Russland gehen die westlichen Länder gegen russische Auslandssender vor.
Mais écoutez, monsieur, c'est pas à vous de décider de qui est journaliste ou pas dans ce pays. On est en France, quoi. C'est pas possible.
We will ban in the European Union the Kremlin's media machine. The state-owned Russia Today and Sputnik.
RT, Sputnik, even our video agency, roughly, all banned on YouTube.
Et merci à vous tous pour votre fidélité et votre soutien.
Okay, welcome back to The Sanchez Effect. I'm Rick Sanchez. Let me show you and read for you some of these words that were so horrible from Mr. Medvedev that they caused Mr. Trump to send nuclear friggin' submarines off the coast of Russia. All right, here's the first one. We'll put it up for you so you can see it. Trump's playing the ultimatum game with Russia. 50 days or 10. He should remember two things. Russia isn't Israel or even Iran. Each new ultimatum is a threat and a step toward war. Not between Russia and Ukraine, but with his own country. Don't go down the Sleepy Joe road. Okay, that's the first one. Here's the other one. He says, about the dead economy of India and Russia and entering dangerous territory, well, let him remember his favorite movies about the Walking Dead and how dangerous the non-existent in nature dead hand can be. That's what he said. Dead hand, by the way, is referring to a policy from the, actually from the Soviet era, where if the United States strikes, even if they do a hit on, let's say, a city like Moscow, the Russian, or in that case, the Soviet missiles would have already been on the way, heading toward toward the United States or anybody else who had tried to hit Russia at the time. That's what he's referring to with that. By the way, so Danny Heifong, he's a YouTube host. He is an analyst. He's somebody who I watch, as a matter of fact, on YouTube. He has great guests, asks great questions, and talks in general about geopolitics and many of the things that we're talking about right now. And he's kind enough to share his time with us. And he's joining us from the city that doesn't sleep. Ladies and gentlemen, from New York City, Danny Heifong. Danny, how are you, my friend?
I'm good. Thanks so much for having me, Rick. And I really appreciate all your kind words. I respect all the work you've been doing very much. And I'm glad that you have been given such a great platform to talk about the truth of all of these matters.
Well, you know, it's interesting you would say that because, yeah, in many ways, if I had it my way to begin with, I would still be sitting in Washington, D.C. or in Miami doing my show and sharing with the American people a perspective from a country that they should be able to understand and know, even if they disagree with it, right? But the country you and I are from as Americans has decided that we, just like the Soviets at some point, and just like my uncles and my parents at some point in Cuba, are not allowed to receive outside information. My, how the world has flipped. Huh?
Yeah. Yep, that's the period we're living in, Rick. There is a wall-to-wall censorship campaign to silence the truth, especially about empire, because the empire is indeed in decline.
So what do you make of this thing that Trump has just done? I mean, you heard what Ritter said, and you heard what Mearsheimer said. The idea that, I guess, his feelings were hurt, or he didn't like the words that Medvedev used, or whatever, and he decides to send two nuclear subs off the coast of Russia. What do you make of that?
Well, on the surface, it looks like Trump is frustrated with Dmitry Medvedev. But the truth of the matter is that what he's really frustrated with is Russia's approach in general. It is my estimation that Donald Trump believed that when he came into office, he would be able to sit down with the Russian, with his Russian counterparts, and essentially give them a silent ultimatum, which was take a ceasefire, stop this war because I say so. But Russia and Vladimir Putin did no such thing. They had no, they had absolutely no intention of settling this conflict on terms dictated by the United States. And that's why we saw during the early negotiation process, no progress made. The United States hasn't even sent any kind of terms to Russia that would entail a kind of peace settlement. The intention from the very beginning was to force Russia to capitulate. And Russia, given that it's winning the war, would never do such a thing. And so it really is Vladimir Putin's approach, the fact that the leadership of Russia is calmly, quietly going about their business, moving forward on their objectives in the special military operation, and doing so in a manner that is very, very successful, both on the battlefield and in the larger political realm, which has Donald Trump going so mad, and Dmitry Medvedev playing his kind of bad cop social media personality at this point is only really, I think, putting sprinkles on top of the sundae, which is leaving a very bad taste in Donald Trump's mouth. And so this is how Donald Trump reacts to not being able to get his way. And really, I see Donald Trump's personality overall as one of the most purest reflections of how the United States as a hegemon and as an empire really feels about the situation when it comes to Russia-Ukraine. They cannot seem, the leaders, the rulers of this system cannot seem to square the fact that they are not going to get their way when it comes to Ukraine, and yet they can't seem to detach themselves from this losing proxy war that they themselves started. And so the fact that Donald Trump sent nuclear submarines is once again another reflection of how the United States has nuclear war on its mind. Donald Trump said himself, we are prepared for nuclear war. The truth is that actually the United States isn't prepared for nuclear war, because nobody is, because a nuclear war, as Russia has said recently through statements from Dmitry Peskov, would be a loss for everybody. This is why Russia has developed the Arestnik missile, because it has the capacity to go 5,000 plus kilometers in a matter of minutes and cause a damage without the nuclear cost equivalent to a similar kind of weapon. So Russia is preparing for a long war. It's preparing for a bloody war. It already has been one, especially for the Ukrainian side. But Russia all along has been preparing for a war with NATO. That's what it sees Ukraine as. And the Trump administration isn't fooling anyone. Donald Trump hasn't fooled Putin, and he hasn't fooled anyone in Russia's leadership. And Dmitry Medvedev is simply stating these terms in the most crass and most outward kind of form.
Yeah.
And I think the most important statement is that Russia is not Israel. Russia is not Iran. It's not going to simply negotiate for negotiating terms, and it's not going to do whatever the United States says. Even though Iran, I would say, is not doing such a thing. Iran, however, does view negotiations as very important, because it needs sanctions to be lifted. But Russia is in no such position, because the sanctions are actually not having much of an impact at all. Well, so the situation is very grim.
The United States is really in no position. You have to have a lot of gall to call yourself a referee when you're a participant. It would be like you and I are playing a basketball game right now. I'm playing against you, and I'm losing to you. And in the middle of the game, I take out a whistle and start blowing it and saying that I'm calling a timeout and I'm going to go get some 7'2" guys to play against you. I mean, you can't do that. I mean, either you're the participant or you're the referee. You can't be both. Do you think Mr. Trump doesn't understand that, perhaps? Like, he really thinks he's the mediator and that the United States is not really the ones who are fighting Russia in this case?
Well, Donald Trump is the definition of a narcissist, and Donald Trump wouldn't even deny such a fact that he is very high on himself. And one thing he would probably deny, though, is that this narcissism often takes a very childlike form. And this isn't a kind of personal attack, because liberals, Democrats, they love the mental health, they love the personal kind of attacks on Donald Trump. This is just an observation based on how he actually behaves in response and connection to actual policies that he employs. So it simply is just an observation. But if we were children, if we were in the United States at school playing sports and we acted like Donald Trump has, it's most likely as a coach or the teacher or whoever would put us in timeout, because that is the way that Donald Trump is behaving, as someone who needs to take a timeout. He needs to, cool off. And he needs to tap into whatever is left of any kind of rational thinking. But actually, I think the point here has been, and I've seen some who were very hopeful about Trump coming into office and perhaps reversing some
including
of Biden's
me.
Wars.
I was.
I think that we're seeing for some who were very high on Donald Trump is that there was a belief that because Donald Trump occupied a certain position, because he was so attacked by certain elements of the establishment, that he would, for the sake of his own legitimacy and his need to look strong and to actually hold a kind of popular mandate for at least a little while, maybe months, maybe into the first couple years of his administration, that's all been burst asunder, because what I think was not factored in was the fact that the United States is actually in a much worse position in terms of its foreign policy and its role as a hegemon than perhaps was assumed when he took office. The fact is that the Ukraine conflict is absolutely dead in the water. The situation in West Asia is out of control. And Gaza, Iran, all of this, it's spinning into a situation that will indefinitely drag the United States into endless war there. And of course, the bigger conflict with China is really already a defeat for the United States. It's just a matter of how extreme the United States will go to try to stop China, which not only will fail, but will likely lead to another kind of catastrophic war in the very near future.
This latest thing with Mr. Trump telling the Indians and the Chinese and the Brazilians and whoever else he adds, I suppose, tomorrow, that if they continue to be friends with Russia, I sound like I'm talking about somebody in high school here. If they continue to be friends with Russia, then they can forget about being friends with the United States, and the United States is going to punish them and no longer be their friend. It almost seems to me, Danny, like if I were any one of those three or four countries, I would then say, hey, this gal over here who's criticizing us in high school, why don't we just form our own club? And we don't really need to be friends with her if she doesn't want to be friends with us. I mean, I know, I feel like I'm describing a teenage movie here, but that's kind of what it sounds like. But it almost makes sense for me if we hear tomorrow that China, Russia, Brazil, South Africa, India are just going to come closer together and tell Mr. Trump, look, keep threatening, keep whatever you want to do, do whatever you want to do. Don't you get that sense? And is that your expectation?
It's already happening, Rick. We just witnessed the BRICS summit, which some had a low opinion on, thought that it wasn't going to achieve much, actually achieve a lot. And a lot of that was in part due to Donald Trump's constant threats toward all of these BRICS countries that you mentioned, and now employing what are disastrous policies in the economic realm in the form of tariffs. Recently, actually, the tariffs on Brazil, for example, have led to Brazil actually just re-diverting its very lucrative coffee industry to China now. So China is going to have that market secure. And I've been to China several times recently in the last few years. Let's just say that there's a huge market and huge demand for coffee drinkers in China. They love coffee. It's becoming so much more popular than ever before, and Chinese brands dominate. But now Brazil will have the first dibs on that market as a foreign investor. And Donald Trump has essentially handed that to China. And this is what he continues to do across the spectrum here, because the fact is that India cannot afford to stop oil trading with Russia. It would be suicidal. We already saw with the EU trade deal with the United States that basically plummeting your economy and destroying yourself for the sake of U.S. LNG and U.S. oil is absolute suicide. And we've seen that from the destruction of Nord Stream through the sanctions on Russia, on Europe. And now they have basically shown the Global South, they've shown BRICS, exactly why that model is such a disaster. So the United States under Donald Trump, it believes that tariffs are an economic weapon similar to the way sanctions are. And Donald Trump didn't learn the lesson that sanctions on Russia failed. Arguably, even if sanctions have had an impact on Iran, they have failed too because they haven't caused regime change. And we can go all across the board, all around the world, how what usually happens is that governments, what they do is they re-divert and redirect all of their economic resources that they can to their own people, and then they search for alternatives. And China, Russia, BRICS, they are a very attractive alternative because they don't impose any of these kind of terms and diktats on to countries willing to do business and trade. And so China, with this massive economy growing at 5% per year, above the expectations of all Western economists, the United States, which actually grew in last quarter in the negative and is stagnant. And you just saw, Rick, Donald Trump had to fire the head of the data compiler of the latest jobs report in the Bureau of Labor.
When you don't like the message, shoot the messenger.
And a lot of that is due to tariffs, because it's not even so much that the tariffs themselves are creating the economic headwinds, which ultimately they are creating a negative impact, especially on inflation. There are attacks on Americans, but it's the way that these actions reflect upon and influence the larger corporate and financial investor class, which sees tariffs as a potential hit on their own profits. So what they do is they pull back, because they realize that what's going to happen is foreign countries, foreign companies, and foreign investors are going to pull back. And so what we are seeing is the United States under Trump pulling the U.S. economy actually further into stagnation. And that is only going to be to the benefit of BRICS and, of course, Russia, China, and the rising Global South. So ultimately, this is what's happening, right? And this was probably inevitable from the very beginning, because the U.S. isn't going to compete on a fair basis anyway. It's pick your poison. It's either the U.S. is going to wage war against these countries, it's going to wage economic war, what have you. But Donald Trump is choosing methods and means that actually accelerate this process, but probably faster than what was expected.
Wouldn't you think, though, that there's got to be a Danny Haifong somewhere in the administration? That there, I remember listening to J.D. Talk. You know, I grew up in the same town. I know Marco Rubio. He's, you know, kind of one of my contemporaries, a Cuban guy who grew up in South Florida. I heard him at the beginning say a few things where I thought, hey, finally, somebody's talking about BRICS. Somebody even knows what BRICS is. Most Americans have never even heard of BRICS. They think it's something you make your house with. I heard, you know, the McGregors making me feel like there was going to be people there who were going to understand these things. Who are these people who are talking to the president, informing the president? Are they just complete numbskulls? Are they idiots? Do they not know any of this stuff that you and I and anybody who can read should know?
Well, these people that you're speaking of, they are the unelected elites, and they are those who represent the biggest lobbyist firms, the biggest corporations. They are those in the revolving door, which Marco Rubio and these kinds of folks are they come out of. Marco Rubio is an ardent neocon. He always has been.
Yep.
And he played such he practiced. All of these politicians are actors, and he practiced a lot in the beginning of the Trump administration to make himself look the part of a so-called diplomat. And now, of course, we've seen how that has gone completely awry. And he essentially is not even the Department of State head. He's not the Secretary of State anymore. He is simply posing as that because that was a concession that Donald Trump gave to the Adelsons of the world and the neocons in order to further his career and to further Marco Rubio's career. So
you forgot one thing, according to some of the estimates that I've seen. And, some of the conversations I've had with Max, for example, the Adelsons gave Mr. Trump up to $500 million. That's a lot of money. I might consider doing whatever you want me to do, Danny, if you give me 500 cash. It's like,
yeah. And Rubio is their guy, and they want Rubio to have a long career in U.S. politics, including possibly the presidency itself, and which is just a nightmarish thought. But it is one that Americans should prepare for because there's going to be a presidential election that includes Marco Rubio in it. So, but the point is here is they don't care. It's not so much that they don't know because they have think tanks up the wazoo, which constantly talk about war games with China. They talk about the economic cost of tariffs. They talk about how BRICS and the Global South are coming together. And what they also talk about, though, is a larger foreign policy agenda of the United States, which really is the foreign policy agenda of this unelected elite, the financiers, the bankers, and, of course, the deep state, which is really their hired operatives, the military-industrial complex, et cetera. They have an overall plan that they can't go back on, even if it has negative ramifications for themselves. What they... And you see this in Donald Trump's actions poking Russia, right? Some people say poking the bear, seeing how far they can go with Russia. They hope that their aggression, their absolute and total pursuit of full spectrum dominance will simply will these countries into submission. And the threat of just... absolute disastrous force. We see this in Gaza, for example. I think Gaza really is a message to the world that the United States and, of course, Israel as its ally will cause absolute and total destruction and cause immense suffering just to get their way, even if it's unachievable. I think that's the model. The model is that the United States will do as a hegemon anything it can to get its way, no matter the cost. And so, to me, it's not so much that they're dumb, it's that they see any other pathway as existential for them, that if they take any other pathway, then it means that the United States will have to accept being number two, number three, number four, just another country, just a normal country in the world, as a lot of Chinese officials say, to as their hopes for the United States, that it will become a normal country, it'll operate in international law, it will be as big and as successful or whatever it is on its own, but that it will not operate as a dictator and a hegemon. The United States' rulers, the elites, they can't accept that because that means fewer profits. That means following laws that they cannot stomach. And that also means allow Russia, China, Iran, the rising multipolar world to exist alongside them. And they have no interest in mutual coexistence. And what we are seeing with Ukraine, we're seeing that with China, we're seeing that with Iran. There's a reason why Donald Trump can't reverse course, because the truth is that nobody sitting in his position is going to be allowed to anyway.
Wow. And if he does or tries to, they'll JFK him. I mean, it would not be that crazy to think that something like that would be possible. But, the picture that you just drew for us is one where the people who are elected by the citizens of the United States have nothing to do with the running of the United States, at least not in important things like war and peace. And those people who are running the United States are determined to rule the world, literally. They have to be number one. They have to be the rulers. They can't share that leadership. They have to dominate. They have to have dominion of that leadership. And that's a that you have phrased it so well, and it's hard for me to argue with you as I look at the actions of the United States over the past several decades. You happen to have really good sources and have a full understanding of the situation in China. Let me ask you first and foremost, there were some reports I heard over the last 48 hours from the United States that China was building up its military to somehow, I don't want to say invade, but maybe do something into Taiwan. What do you make of that report, and what have you heard on it, or what can you share?
Well, these reports actually come out of every so often. They're very frequent. They often start on social media, actually, with very little sources or evidence to the fact. The fact is, though, and the truth is that China is preparing for war. China is developing and advancing a very modern military. It has the largest aircraft carrier in the world now. It has hypersonic missiles that we can't even count. It has 600 nuclear warheads. It has the capacity to defend itself. But at the same time, China hasn't changed its position on Taiwan. Its position is peaceful reunification first, that Taiwan is a part of one China, and that any attempts to separate from China, whether from forces on the island and, of course, the U.S. supporting them, will be met with a response. And a lot of this, it was so interesting because I covered this report, Rick, is that it came out around the same time that the Center for Strategic and International Studies, this State Department think tank, came out with more wargaming. They wargame around Taiwan a lot, but this time they wargamed around the effects of a potential blockade imposed by China on Taiwan. And the results were disastrous, of course. China has all the capabilities and all of the resources to essentially cut off the island of Taiwan economically from the rest of the world in a matter of minutes to hours. Mm. So, but I think the coincidence of this is that China has already demonstrated, back when Nancy Pelosi visited the island of Taiwan a few years ago, all the way up into all of these other visits from U.S. officials and those like Mike Pompeo outside of U.S. officialdom now, every time this happens, China employs very intense military drills around the island, mimicking a blockade. And they do this to show that it is very possible to do very quickly, and that this is going to be the big cost, not necessarily for the people of Taiwan, because China does not want to cut off Chinese people living in Taiwan from an economic lifeline that they absolutely need in mainland China. But they want to show to the United States and the rest of the world that there are consequences to interfering with the internal affairs of the Chinese nation. And so China is preparing for war, but there is no military, quote unquote, invasion imminent. It's difficult to invade territory that is already your own under both international law as well as through many agreements signed, three joint communiques signed with the United States over the last several decades.
So what you're saying is if the U.S. or NATO tries to do in Taiwan exactly what the U.S. and NATO did in Ukraine, for example, essentially take it over, make it theirs in terms of military infrastructure, economy, corruption, whatever, then within 24 hours, China has a plan to essentially surround, blockade, and isolate Taiwan from those bad actors. That's what did I paraphrase what you said? Well,
yeah, and that would be game over for the global economy, because we know how important Taiwan's manufacturing
chips.
Of semiconductor chips are. So, that really is the ultimate aim, because we know, just like Russia has been so careful despite all of the hype and actually hype about Russia's just monstrosity and how it is such an aggressor and does not care about civilians. We know how much Russia has done so much to ensure the minimization of civilian casualties. Mm-hmm. Of course, China is very much on the same wavelength as that. It's not going to wage any kind of war that will put the Chinese citizens on Taiwan at risk,
but what it would be killing, because it would be killing its own people, right? I mean, that's what.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. To them, they see. I mean, this is the thing. Yeah, yeah, they see them as brothers. They see them as sisters. they have family connections. The economic connections are very deep. So, yeah, China will impose the maximum amount of costs with the least amount of suffering possible for the people on the island. But I think what often happens, Rick, when we talk about these things, especially for people in the collective West who are so enamored by the boom, boom, bang, bang of war, is that people begin to start underestimating China when they see Taiwan be armed with billions of U.S. dollars worth of weapons, when they see the U.S. supporting separatism, and they ask, similar to what the hell they ask, how people ask about Ukraine, well, why doesn't China just do something about this? Well, China wants to avoid a war with the United States because it would be very costly for everybody in the world. But also, I think it's wrong-headed to underestimate China's capacity to do exactly what it says it will do if the United States, backing these separatists, crosses a red line and pushes them to try to separate the island from Taiwan and try to form some kind of independent nation. When and if that should happen, and I do think it really is a win, because I don't believe the United States has any other play in the region that they can even really move on. So if this is the only option to move on militarily, China will act, and it will be swift and decisive, and the United States will be put in the position, similar to how they are in a position in Ukraine. Similarly, they'll be put in a position to decide how they are going to act. Are they going to react recklessly and try to do something which will absolutely cause economic and military wreckage for the United States? Or will they pull back and say, this isn't our fight? It's most likely the former, and I think that's where their big danger is.
What about the South China Sea and the constant conflict that we see there, with the U.S. saying that China is overreaching on many of those islands and getting the support of Malaysia and Japan and all those other countries in that region?
Well, this is an example of how the United States continuously interferes in affairs that it really has no business in interfering with. China, Japan, the Philippines, these countries, they have disputes, sure, but they have mechanisms to resolve these conflicts on their own. It's the United States that wants, through this region, to beef up its military presence. This is why it continuously sends aircraft carriers there, naval carriers there. This is why it continuously strengthens and imposes more and more military diktats on nations like the Philippines, stationing missiles there. All of this is just justification. There really is no quote-unquote South China Sea problem beyond very resolvable disputes between countries like China, Vietnam, China, and the Philippines, which could easily be resolved through diplomatic channels. It's the United States that stands in the way of this and is trying to pull these governments into its camp so that they are more and more willing, when the United States decides that it's time to militarily engage with China, to have them be the staging ground for that. And that is, I believe, a terrible miscalculation on the part of the United States, because it has to rely upon countries that are also very dependent economically on China, ASEAN countries, the countries that reside in parts of the South China Sea. They all really need China to develop their own economies. Without China, they would be in a much more disastrous position than they already are, given decades of extreme poverty and we know Western interference and subjugation, etc. So the fact of the matter is that even we've seen in this trade war, South Korea, Japan, these countries, even the Philippines, these countries have refused to actually cut off economic ties with China. So it's going to be very difficult for them to engage in the kind of conflict that the United States wants them to. And so all of this really is, one, it's a boon for the military-industrial complex. It allows the United States to continue to deploy whatever is left of its manufacturing capacity of these weapons to these regions to justify their continued production. And, of course, the government contracts needed to do that. But it also is what I believe is a huge miscalculation on the part of the United States in terms of its foreign policy, that it believes that it can galvanize so-called allies to do its bidding for it. I actually don't believe that in the final analysis that will end up being the case, because these countries, especially the people, are going to have to consider, well, what is more worth it, fighting a hateful war with China that is really just sowing more and more divisions and claiming China is the big bad guy here, or and then going to war and dying for the United States, or developing deeper ties with China, regardless of whatever you think of its system, in order to become more prosperous. This is the deal, I think, that China offers, which is almost unbeatable in the sense that what offer would we all take in that sense? If you just put yourself in that position, die for a dying empire, or have a better life trading with a country with a lot of resources, manufacturing capacity, high technology, et cetera, and willing to do that at a very fair price. I think we would all choose the latter if we have any rational elements in our minds. I think we would choose the latter.
Let me ask you one final question about our country, the United States of America, in particular where you are right now, New York City, perhaps one of the most enlightened parts of the United States in terms of people actually doing crazy things like reading books and things like that. What do you sense is the general sentiment in the United States these days? Are people going to be able to ever wise up to some of the things that you and I are talking about? I mentioned earlier, for example, most people in the United States, they don't even know what BRICS is because they're not told anything by the media. And the media, you know, CNN's a joke, obviously. So is NBC, so is ABC, so is Fox. Now you've got new companies who you'd think would try and create something different, News Nation or Newsmax, for example. They're worse. I mean, they're basically neocon central over there. So for people in America to be informed about anything and have any sense of smarts about them, they've got to listen to you or try and get me somehow, even though it's illegal for them, probably, or actually, you know, they can. Or listen to Tucker or, you know, some other people out there. But that's the only way it seems to me that they can do it. Do you feel like it's cutting through, getting through? What's your sense? You're there.
Yeah. So I think there are many sides of this. And so first, I do believe that we are witnessing a combination of a kind of a malaise among people in the United States. It's really peppered and infused with a lot of frustration, a lot of contempt for the people that rule over us. I think there's no doubt about it that the reason why there's such little public trust in all branches of the US government and why there's so little hope in the economy is just based on the reality of people, how they are living. So living standards are declining and people are more and more frustrated. And that is causing a kind of resentment that I think spans across the political spectrum. It just takes different forms in how people express it on the political spectrum. But there are, I think, signs of a kind of headway being made in people's understanding of especially the United States and its role abroad. So during the trade war on China, when it was first launched, when Trump did the whole Liberation Day in April, what we saw when these tariffs went up to 145% on China and China refused to bow down, where I live, this is a place that even though it's supposedly very liberal and, you know, quote unquote progressive, let's just say there's a lot of people here who just swallow anti-China, anti-Russia propaganda. Yeah. But when this started to happen, when China demonstrated that it was not going to bow down to Donald Trump and his diktats, a lot of people started becoming interested in why that was, how they were able to do it. Hmm. And this was coupled on the fact that Donald Trump tried to escalate and is still trying to in these trade negotiations, a kind of forced sell-off of TikTok, going so far as to ban it for a certain period of time. That led to Xiao Hongshu, the Chinese social media app, exploding in the United States. It's the only app that US users can actually log on to. And people learned a whole lot about China. And this is coupled with the increased consciousness around Gaza and the US role in the absolute horrors that the Palestinian people are suffering at the hands of the US-backed Israeli military. And of course, the Ukraine conflict, which despite the fact that people in the United States have been so inundated with anti-Russia propaganda that being anti-Russia is almost just a knee-jerk reaction now, that has not necessarily led to massive support for the conflict. So we see all these signs that actually people are more and more opposed to these conflicts. You see this in how people talk about it. However, it's the malaise and the stagnation, the frustration that leads to a few things. It leads to, one, some people being more motivated to pursue independent media. It's why mm-hmm. independent media is becoming more popular. And it also leads them to pursue some kind of action, like we see with Palestine, to stop the madness and to stop the horrors and to stop the killing. But it also can lead to, and it has, and we've seen this, a resentment and frustration that is almost dejecting. It's like a loss of faith in American exceptionalism, and that therefore leads to kind of loss in faith in oneself, which is why I believe we see the two-party system, despite being dominated by the same elites, the two-party system continues to survive right. based on the fact that people don't see an alternative and they don't see the capacity to build one. And then internationally too, what I think is going to happen, and what often, and you saw this during the Iraq war, mm-hmm. the U.S. invasion of Iraq, until it begins to impact people in the United States directly,
yes.
right? Like until something like a Ukraine conflict, until a war with China, what's happening in West Asia with Iran, until it affects people in the United States directly, especially in the form of bodies coming home, that's usually when unrest and resentment turns
that's funny.
Into rebellion.
You're right, because they don't feel the $300 billion of their tax money, which could have been used to help their children, to create
right.
A better medical care system, to even just give medical care to anybody who's under the age of 65, like people in Ukraine have and people in Israel have, who are getting the money from U.S. taxpayers. It's absolutely crazy to think about that. Danny, we've run out of time. Congratulations, my friend. I was just thinking about your numbers. You know, you're close to 500,000 subscribers. When I was working at CNN, I was the highest rated anchor there at the time. You may or not remember my show, Rick's List. And I remember I was like patted on the bank every day if I reached, 300,000 viewers on any given day. Here you are. And by the way, they're not getting 300,000 viewers at CNN these days. In the key demo, and here you are reaching on a regular basis millions of people. That's kudos to you, my friend. Props. Well done. It's because you're telling the truth. It's because you work hard. Because you have a good show, and because you have smart people who you talk to. So, my hat's off to you, and thank you so much for coming on and sharing your ideas with us today.
Of course. Thanks so much, Rick, for all you do, and I'm really happy to do it. Appreciate all of your work.
Thank you, sir. Danny Hi-Fi, good enough to join us here with a YouTube show that reaches so many people because it's smart. And that's it from us. You can also check out my podcast, by the way. Not exactly at 500,000 yet, but we're getting there. It's called Journalistically Speaking. Look at it. It's on YouTube. I'm on X, by the way, as well, Rick Sanchez TV, and we can have conversations there. Look forward to hearing from you. And I read just about everything you send, by the way. I don't always respond, but I respond quite a bit as well. Thank you so much for being with us. I'm Rick Sanchez, and we'll be looking for you again next time, by golly.